host intro. There is more to the work of Chicago sculptor Martin Puryear than meets the eye, and that's what makes his work so powerful. As the New York Times recently noted, Puryear is the first artist to have been included in exhibitions at all four major Manhattan museums, as well as the New Museum of Contemporary Art, before having his first solo show in a New York gallery, though he by now has had that too. And you might check and see if his exhibit's still at the David McKee Museum Gallery on 57th Street, and then you could fix that. Based in Chicago, Puryear has generated all of this attention and critical acclaim by embellishing his seemingly simple works with layers of meaning. As Marge Halperin reports, it is work that speaks to many people on many levels. The first job of a critic, it often seems, is to label an up-and-coming artist. But when they try to label Martin Puryear, it just doesn't work. Many of his sculptures are single pieces, meant for museum floor or wall, unadorned, making a statement with space as well as with form and with material, usually wood. But Puryear's range also extends to art as landscape, sculpture integrated with nature, using the same feel for space and form. Clearly, labels and rules are not what dictate this artist, as art form contributor Judith Rusi Kirshner has discovered.
You can't understand a work by Martin Puryear by just looking at it. You have to walk around it, give it time. It takes a while. It's sort of a slow take. So it's a more subtle engineering of one's response to works of art.
Kirshner goes so far as to suggest Puryear plots his work so that it can't be categorized, and Puryear admits that might be true.
The backbone of the work is something that possibly eludes definition. What for me is important is keeping my own options clear and keeping my own central attack or central direction clear for myself. It's like something you're trying to hold on to through a lot of vicissitudes, both outside the studio, outside your own life, and inside your own personality. It's trying to hold on to something that's very much yours through all the changes.
It's a struggle that lends an intensity to Puryear's art, giving balance to his gentle sense of humor and setting up one of so many dichotomies that make up the man and his work. Sometimes the pull of opposites is obvious, as with Box and Pole, an outdoor sculpture that pairs a 100-foot pole with a solid box. Rather than opposites, Puryear labels the concept equivalence in a work that juxtaposes a cube and a cone. But in other pieces, he mixes closed shapes with open mesh, light wood with dark felt. And most often, he mixes contemporary design with well-researched historical craftsmanship.
Each material has its, for me, demands its own kind of respectful use. And for me, that use involves understanding the history of the material, the way it's been used by mankind in the past. And in a sense, that becomes a language. And for me, perhaps a theme is the reverberations of this use, this way of using certain materials, and in some cases, celebrating that in the work.
As for the themes of specific works, Puryear is, like most artists, content to let the pieces speak for themselves. His medium is visual, not verbal. But even if he can articulate his message in some cases, he won't.
Some of that is kind of like explaining a joke. I mean, it has the same capacity to totally deflate what is there. It's just giving it away in a way where, mm-hmm. in a certain sense, the public can engage things and kind of masticate it and digest it and make an effort to understand. I think work is most interesting when there is an engagement, a kind of mutual engagement, and not just something delivered up that the public can sort of swallow whole without a blink and get. The public has to be made, in a sense, interested enough to want to do that.
And so Puryear gives us a few clues by way of his titles. Often they're a play on words or a snippet of research that gets the viewer started on the road to discovery. There's the landscape piece titled Bodark Arc, a bow-shaped path through an Illinois college campus that uses a hedge of Osage orange trees as the bowstring. Osage orange trees were called Bodark by the Indians, who used the wood to make their bows. Just as we're drawn into Puryear's research, we're drawn along the walkway that he's created for us. Perhaps the greatest dichotomy in this artist is the pull between his desire to communicate with his viewers and his need for privacy. Puryear grants few interviews, worried that his personality and not his work will become the focus of attention. And yet, as he mixes museum and collector's pieces with public commissions, Puryear finds himself intensely curious about his mass audience's reaction to his work. His River Road Ring, a fluid wood circle, is suspended in air above Chicago commuters, just a short train ride from Puryear's home. Sometimes he'll take the train there, watching others as they watch his sculpture.
I did come across a guy who was looking at it and got in a conversation with him, and he pretty roundly condemned it as another kind of thing that was foisted on the public by them. And then I told him that it was derived after a lot of thought to give a very particular kind of experience from a great number of vantage points. It was meant to engage a viewer going up and down the steps or the moving stairs, the escalator. And as the viewer moved, this sort of big wooden halo would go into an ellipse and flatten itself out and briefly become a line, mm-hmm. a slanted line, and then open up again to become an ellipse and finally a circle again. And how I was interested in that whole dynamic and how I found it was very beautiful. And he said, now that I see what you're about, I can at least respect your intention.
Puryear isn't dogmatic about his work. He's fascinated by the development of his pieces under his own hands, and then by their further development under the gaze of others. And that, says Judith Russi Kirshner, is what makes Puryear's work so compelling.
It does belong to a dialogue. It isn't finite at the moment of the artist's intention. So that even if Martin tells you his intention, that will not exceed the horizons of the piece. How you read the piece, how I read the piece, become part of its meaning too. If it's going to last, it will mean something to him when he makes it, and to you when you see it, and to me when I write about it, and to our children maybe 20 years from now when they see it in the museum.
Right now, Martin Puryear is working on a Washington, D.C. exhibition, on a pair of twin granite columns for the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, and on what he calls amenities, a fountain, benches, and a system of trellises and arbors for a garden park in Chevy Chase, Maryland. But woven through all of these works is the overriding project of guarding his personality and integrity against an onslaught of admirers who are intent on praising the artist as well as the art. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
Sure.
Host intro. Picture an artist hard at work, alone in a small studio, crouched over the latest creation, perhaps working overtime as a piece takes shape. But unless that picture also includes a wide-open window, whirling fan, and respirating face mask, a serious illness could also be taking shape. As Marge Halperin reports, Congress is now putting the final touches on legislation that would require the manufacturers of artist materials to put a warning label on the many hazardous substances artists routinely use. It's not just a matter of knowing what to use, but also of knowing where and how to use paints, solvents, markers, and other artist products safely. The labels Congress is considering would include a list of ingredients in artist materials, their possible side effects, and instructions on what ventilation, protective clothing, or other precautions are required. Because it's an artist's job to think of creative new ways to use materials, these guidelines will serve as a tip-off when artists begin to get sick. One of the chief architects of the plan is Pam Gilbert, an attorney for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group in Washington. She recalls congressional testimony from an oil painter who suffered from kidney problems.
He went to the doctor, and what the doctor did was prescribe that he do his artwork while he was recuperating because it would be good for his psyche. He lost a kidney. It had to be removed. And he still didn't know it was because of the art products that he was using. Then he happened to be reading the literature, and he discovered that solvents and oil paints have a history of doing this to kidneys.
Chicago artist Mary Furlong figured out her problem much earlier. She was diagnosed as suffering from solvent stupor after working for several months in a silk screening studio with no ventilation.
The effect of a lot of these solvents is that there is an actual high. I can testify to that. And I think a lot of artists are under some type of delusion. Being high and working till 3 in the morning is not a result of their creative process, it's a result of the materials, and they might actually do better artwork if they weren't inhaling those fumes. They don't have to lose their sanity and their health for their art.
Once Furlong made the connection between her job and her own dizziness, clumsiness, and memory loss, she switched to the safer field of computer graphics. Others may not be so versatile, and that's what concerns artist-turned-public health advocate Gail Berezani. She knows that beyond adding a mask or window fan, many artists are unable to substantially improve their working conditions.
It's also a question of economics in many cases. It costs money to have the proper equipment. You may not know how to do the ventilation, and you might need advice, someone, engineer, to come in and help you put in proper ventilation. It's tremendously expensive.
Pam Gilbert hopes a congressional labeling law will help even starving artists by giving manufacturers incentive to make their products safer. In fact, she says that's already begun to happen under a less comprehensive voluntary standard adopted by the industry 5 years ago.
Some of these products are more dangerous than they need to be. And so now that they have to label their product with perhaps a cancer warning label or a reproductive damage warning label, that's a very troubling thing for a consumer to see and still buy a product. Manufacturers understand that, and when they can, they're reformulating their product.
Gilbert expects Congress to vote on the art materials labeling plan within the next 2 months, and she expects it to pass, tacked on as an amendment to a bill renewing the general powers of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which would oversee the new labels. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. Jesse Jackson showed his flair for symbolism by taking his campaign to the mostly white South Suburban Cicero, and the symbolism wasn't lost on those who joined Jackson outside a soon-to-be-closed factory.
We've lost 100,000 jobs in the last two decades here in Cicero, and for Jesse Jackson to care about that from a town that's hated his people forever shows what a kind of a man he is, and I want to support him any way I can.
Michael Dukakis targeted the working man, too, at a steel plant on Chicago's far south side.
Nobody's going to tell me as I walk around this plant that our steel industry in this country can't be competitive.
Albert Gore made his own factory stop today while Paul Simon stumped downstate. The Democrats and Republican candidates promise voters here will be seeing a lot more of them throughout the week. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. In a spy novel, this would be called The Case of the Disappearing Checks, because that's what they do. They vanish with barely a trace, and never enough evidence remaining to track the culprits. Chicago Police Detective Gregory Dan says often the checks start to fall apart within hours of when they've been presented.
Well, the first thing that appears to go is the microencoding, but has the account number and the routing number and the dollar amount put on it later. And then the rest of the check just falls and basically dissolves into pieces, like.
Obviously, this is the work of someone who knows how the banking system works. First of all, anyone with a bank account knows you can't walk in, present a check for $4,000, the amount on many of these bogus checks, and walk out with cash. There's a 5-day hold while the bank waits to be sure the check clears. What most of us don't know, however, is that the hold is lifted if the bank doesn't get word that the check bounced. No one will report in on the millions of good checks processed each day, and no one will report that there's trouble with a check that has disintegrated. The bank hears no bad news and releases the funds. At least that's how the caper has been working. Now that authorities have been alerted, banks around the city are tightening security. Those that don't make a practice of microfilming each check as soon as it comes in will now be in more of a hurry. And tellers are being warned that the treated checks often come into the bank feeling wet or oily. They may even give off chemical fumes. That's unusual, but hadn't been enough to stop a transaction until now, according to First Chicago Bank's assistant vice president in charge of corporate affairs, Peter Soraparu. He says his bank has sent all tellers a list of clues to watch for.
Where a check is drawn, the location of the bank on where a check is drawn, the physical appearance of the check, the feel of the check, and certainly just the types of things that tellers might be on the lookout for in any case, you know, large amount, if it's a known customer, that sort of thing.
At Chicago's branch of the Federal Reserve Bank, nearly 4 million checks are processed each day. The disappearing checks are quite unusual, but they involve so little money that they haven't even caused a ripple in operations at the Fed. They do make for good conversation around the office, though. Fed researcher Bob Laurent says he, for one, is convinced we've seen the last disintegrating check, at least for some time.
It seems pretty well thought out, and I would think that if they understand it that well, I would believe they probably planned on making a lot of money fairly quickly. But now that it's widely publicized, I suspect they wouldn't even try it again. So if they've managed to get away so far, I suspect they're all right.
Of course, there's always the chance of copycats picking up where the originator of the scheme left off. Chicago police are looking out for that possibility. They're not making it easy, though, keeping the name of the substance used a closely guarded secret. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. To the uninitiated, particularly to the many American tourists who pass through the highlands of Central America, the colorful clothing of the Maya Indians adds a festive touch to the native villages. But it does much more than that, as one learns on a visit to the current exhibit at Chicago's Mexican Fine Arts Museum. As Marge Halperin reports, the Living Maya is a dazzling display of hand-woven Mayan clothing, complemented by a sprinkling of legend and music, completing the Mayan story. For perhaps 1,000 years, Mayan women have been hand-weaving their family's clothing, bright huapiles for the women to wear as blouses, and cotones, the men's shirts that are no less elaborate. This exhibit includes a collection of photographs. Smiling faces are encircled with colorful headdresses, and flamboyant scarves serve as belts hanging to the floor. Rene Arceo, Arts and Education Director for the Mexican Fine Arts Museum, says the designs on each garment reflect its roots.
There are about 50 different traditional designs, basically one per town. There is a design for Santa Magdalena, Chalchihuitan, Chinalo, Chamula, and all the other towns. Now, there are hundreds and thousands of huipiles that have been already made, but there are not two huipiles that are exactly the same. They will still be slightly different, but it will still correspond to the traditional clothing of their town.
These designs serve as more than a map, though. They're also a history book, packed full of the culture's legends. A toad signals rain for bountiful crops. The diamond shape represents the universe. A butterfly stands for the sun in the sky. Storyteller Carmen Aguilar, seated at the corner of the gallery, tells visitors why huapiles will often display a corn plant.
Every Mayan family, it doesn't matter if they have a big piece of land, every Mayan family has a plant, a corn plant, near the house, because corn is sacred for the Mayas. They believe that every grain of corn is a tear from the sun. And when the Mayan family has a corn plant near the house, that means that they are going to have enough food, that the family is going to be together always, that they are going to have peace, that they are going to have many animals, and they are going to be very happy.
The weaver's stylized version of a corn plant and the other intricate designs are occasionally embroidered onto hand-woven fabric, but more often they're woven in as the cloth itself is made, a technique known as brocade. It's tedious work. Weavers complete only about an inch of fabric each day. Traditionally, the job falls to women, who fashion looms from sticks, then hang them from trees or from the corner of their homes, weaving only when other household chores are finished. It's the way they worked for generations. Under the influence of more technologically advanced societies, the Mayan weavers began weaving with synthetic materials, using yarns dyed with artificially bright pigments. It's only recently that the Indians have taken an interest in reviving their old ways. Arceo says the move is spearheaded by the sponsors of this exhibit, a weaver's cooperative known as Snaholobil, the House of Weaving, which won't allow members to use synthetic materials.
Indian people love the bright colors, and it is a lot easier to get threads that have much brighter colors than through the use of natural dyes. They're still trying to study more about the natural colors and how to make them brighter. And that's one of the purposes of Snaholobil, to provide scholarships for people to study not only the ancient ways of weaving and designs, but also to study about the natural dyes that have been used for centuries, but in a way that were lost, and now they're trying to revive him, to bring him back to life.
It isn't always easy to cultivate the Maya's interest in their heritage. Though this is work steeped in tradition, few weavers seem to know as much about their art as do American scholars. One of the few male weavers, Pedro Mesa Mesa, is traveling with this exhibit to demonstrate his art. Ask him why he weaves, and he says he's enjoyed the bright colors since he first saw his mother and grandmother weave. But he's at a loss when asked what each symbol represents.
Este es el diseño de los opilotes. Esos son flores con
this is the design of the vultures. Esto over here. This is the flowers with the spines over here. This is the design of the rings, and this is the design of the paws of the dog, the paw prints.
What do those represent? Why paw prints?
Pues, no sé, las tejedoras que inventaron.
I don't know, but it's been typical for many years, this particular design.
What about the vulture? What does that signify?
Porque está ahí, no sé, bueno... Nunca me contaron por qué este.
The idea of the design is that it doesn't change, that it's part of the tradition. And as part of the tradition, we try to maintain it.
Pero no conozco cuentos sobre su pilote.
But he doesn't understand.
With a laugh, Pedro Mesa Mesa's American friends translate his answer as, "That's not my job, man." Mesa Mesa says it's up to the weavers to carry on the weaving and up to the scholars to interpret the art. And so, as we sat in the middle of the gallery, those who had toured the exhibit chimed in with their own explanations of the symbols they saw. And far from being offended, Mesa Mesa seemed pleased to see his art come alive in this culture as well as in his own. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
This design, which is a diamond design, that's a symbol of the earth and the world, the universe. That's how the world is to them. And in a way, it's not only mythological, but it's almost a ritual that they have. Because as you can see, the opening for the neck is not round like most of our clothing. It's more like a square, more like the diamond again and more like the earth and the world. So when they put on the huipil, the Indian actually becomes the center of the world, the center of the universe, and they are surrounded by all these experiences that are woven, all this mythology and the history.
Not only are we going to hear a whole night, and into the early hours of the morning, are we going to hear some genuine house rock and music live here at the Riviera, but we're also raising money tonight for the queen of the blues and one great human being, Coco Taylor.
Well, the lady sings. She's just a blues mama. She's a blues mama. I mean, she just wails the blues, you know.
She's the only lady out there can sing the blues hard like a man.
She's got the blues, what's happening. She puts it out, she belts it out. And that's the thing I like about Coco, you know.
As you can hear on her latest live album, An Audience with the Queen, Coco Taylor is no cream puff. That's what she calls the traditional soft sound that usually marks women in the blues. But the Queen does not croon. She wrote I'm a Woman, her own favorite, in answer to bluesman Muddy Waters' coming-of-age anthem.
Where the men are singing and talking about the women's waiting and waiting for them to come home when sometimes they never return, I'm showing them where. Don't just sit and wait. You know, like this one tune I did. It says, here's some food for thoughts, and I hope you understand. I can love you like a woman, but well, also fight you like a man, and don't think nothing about it.
Ask anyone in the blues business what makes Coco Taylor the queen, and they'll quickly tell you she made it because she's tough.
Well, I saw her pull a gun on a promoter once to get paid. Just asked him to honor the contract. He was having trouble remembering to honor the contract, and she reminded him of what was on the contract.
Bruce Iglauer, Taylor's manager and the president of Alligator Records, her label, says Taylor is the best-selling female blues artist in the world. She got there the hard way, coming to Chicago at the age of 18 when her then-boyfriend, now-husband, Pops Taylor, was looking for work. Coco spent her free time in the city's blues clubs, parlaying her experience in her church choir into a few guest spots on stage. She was discovered there by Willie Dixon of Chicago's old Chess Records. He took her on board and wrote her first big hit in 1967.
At a time when blues for black people was dying, you know, we couldn't get arrested doing the blues because when her record came out, everything then was the rock groups and the invasion of the English groups, the Beatles, the Stones, that type of thing. And the good blues players really couldn't make any money. And Pops Coco with a hit.
Session musician Gene Barge played sax on Wang Dang Doodle and was on stage much of the night last night, joining such names as Albert Collins, Lonnie Brooks, Robert Cray, and Kim Wilson. While they sang the blues, Coco Taylor smiled and waved from a VIP box.
She's aching head to foot, but she had to be here. Coco!
Though she's planning to cut back a bit on her schedule, which used to keep her on the road 10 months of the year, Coco Taylor is slated to go back on stage at the end of May. In the meantime, fans will have to be content with her latest album. As the mom and pops of Chicago's tightly knit blues family, the Taylors had promised to pay their band's medical bills from the accident. But last night's sellout show took care of that, raising over $50,000 for the benefit of the Queen. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
Thank you.
Charlie.